being a banker for 21 years almost.
That's okay. It's going to fuel you. It's still, I think, fueling me to this day.
Somebody that's a little bit bored should be waiting a long time. So people are just going to have to roll up their sleeves.
Try to make sense of it because there's so much information coming in and you don't know what's relevant and what's not.
The corporate world for 4 years as a CEO.
I'm not interested in having this small probability of losing a whole lot of money.
You need to be surrounded by other smart people.
Got me through the door because it's a pretty small group and it's
Hello, everyone. This is your host, Maura Maya. Welcome to another episode of the Finance Podcast, where I explore the professional journey of individuals who have successfully built careers in the financial industry. This episode is particularly interesting as we will be talking about COVID-19 and its effect on markets and how this will all play out. My guest this week is Ryan Oldham, a portfolio manager in the equity division at Fidelity Investments. Fidelity Investments is a leading provider of investment management, retirement planning, portfolio guidance, brokerage, benefits outsourcing, and other financial products and services to more than 26 million individuals, institutions, and financial intermediaries. Prior to assuming his current position, Mr. Oldham was responsible for research that opportunistically searched for best ideas across the Canadian market from 2013 to 2018. Previously, Mr. Oldham served as co-manager of Fidelity Select Natural Gas Portfolio from 2012 to 2013, and as a manager of the fund from 2010 to 2012. He also covered research of large cap domestic and Canadian international exploration and production companies from 2007 to 2013. Mr. Oldham earned his Bachelor of Commerce degree from Concordia University's John Wilson School of Business and his Master's of Business Administration degree from McGill University. He is also a CFA charter holder. So please enjoy my conversation with Ryan Oldham.
Hi, Ryan. Thank you for taking the time for being on the podcast today. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. So I want to get right into it. And I want to ask you, before we get into understanding your day-to-day journey as a portfolio manager for Fidelity Investments, I want to discuss your story. So how does it all start?
Yeah, so it's not that interesting. I grew up in Montreal, Canada, just west of Montreal in Beaconsfield. And I went to Beaconsfield High School. And, you know, I always loved the idea of making money. Early on, I had a paper route. I would save my allowance. You know, the funny story my parents used to always say was, you know, they would give me like $2 a week for an allowance. And at the end of the year, I would buy a $100 savings bond because I like didn't spend any of it, right? So I was really early on motivated by savings and money. And so I had a paper route. I saved my allowance. I worked at Provigo, which is the grocery store in Canada, as a bag boy. I then worked in an Italian restaurant as a bus boy. I always had jobs. All throughout growing up, through high school. I just was really focused on commercial activities early on. So I went to Beaconsfield High School. I then went to Marianopolis for stage up. Actually in science, because early on, although I loved making money, I thought I wanted to be an engineer. That wasn't, you know, looking back, that probably wasn't the thing that I was going to be my best self at. I wasn't that great at the sciences. I did okay, but like it wasn't the thing that like really got me excited. And I took an economics class at Marianopolis and I loved it. It was like exactly what I always liked doing, which was like finding ways to make money. And I learned about markets and I was like, wow, I should have done this earlier. This is amazing. And so I decided at that moment, although I still applied to McGill in engineering, I applied to Concordia in finance. And what you'll learn about me if you get to know me is I like to keep my options open as long as I can. And so I applied to both. And I got into both engineering at McGill and finance at Concordia, and my dad sat me down and was like, you know what? I'm sure you could do engineering, but I just don't see it. I just don't see that in you. So I think you should do finance. And so I went to Concordia and I kept you know, I did that. It was fine. I had a good time in college. I kept working my summers, you know, because I was so focused on making money. I didn't really have internships. I didn't really pay attention to the job boards or the career center, which is like a piece of advice. You should pay attention to that stuff.
Yes. I want to ask, I want to ask about that. So what advice would you tell students while they're in university so that they can later succeed at landing that job in order to enter the industry that is finance?
We'll totally get there, I'm sure. But what I would say is do the interviews, do the on-campus recruiting, do all the things, like know what you want to do. And like work towards that in college. I worked at a mattress factory in the summer. Like my internships, the things I did in the summer didn't help me get my jobs, right? They did teach me about business. So they were great because I learned about unions and like industrial relations. And I worked in a factory and I saw just-in-time management of inventory. And so like in the school of life, I learned a ton. Right. So it was really cool about working in price minus cost type of industry. I learned that in three summers working in a mattress factory. Right. So it was a really cool experience. And there's like a whole story I tell. I figured out at the mattress factory that they would like sell us slightly deficient mattresses at like a discount. And it was like a fantastic deal. And so I would like figure it out to get the best possible mattresses at this discount. And then I would go around and start selling them to family and friends. The demand was so high that I like started to like pool all of the other employees quotas. And I suddenly had like a business where I was selling 25 mattresses a year to people. And I like worked out distribution and the whole thing. And the company found out it didn't love it. And you know, I get that. But it kind of speaks to the way I am, which is like find an opportunity and exploit it. So a fantastic lesson in business and life and stuff like that, but not the path to, you know, white collar finance job. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so adding to that in 2002 was not a great year to graduate. That's a long time for you, but it was post 9/11. It wasn't an awesome year. Finance was going through a rough period. So I hadn't really prepped. All my peers were ready for like, they had internships in hand. And like, there was nothing for someone who hadn't even thought about it until like May of the year I graduated, right? So I started hitting the pavement and I found a job at Scotia, coincidentally, in my hometown, like right, like in Kirkland, Beaconsfield area, like 2 minutes from my parents' house. And so I started retail banking. I was literally selling mortgages and bank accounts to the area, like the walk-in clients who wanted banking services. And it wasn't really what I wanted to do, and it wasn't what I had ambitions to do, but it was another good learning experience of what it's like to be at the bottom and kind of work your way up. And like, you know, I did pretty well. I learned how to sell things to people, and that was a great skill. You know, but for me, the day that this couple walked into the branch and wanted to finance a tent trailer was the day that I was like, I have to do something else. Like, I can't finance tent trailers. I need to go do something else. And so I applied internally at Scotiabank for private banking. And I had done pretty well, and I had a good relationship with my boss, and he helped me get the job. And so I went to downtown Montreal to work in Tour Scotia, right across from McGill campus, actually, in the private banking division as like a junior private banker, where I would help the senior private bankers like execute on all of the banking. And that was a really interesting job. I learned about all kinds of different types of structures for more wealthy people. And I met tons of really interesting people. And then, you know, I was always thinking about things then. And I was doing the CFA while I was working there. And I'm like, I love helping people, and that's great. And I, like, being on the client side is fine, but I really want to be the one investing, right? That's what I want to do. I want to be the one investing. And so I decided to do my MBA after 3 years at Scotia, and I threw myself into my MBA. This time I wasn't going to let, I wasn't going to let anything stop me from getting the best opportunities possible. I really tried my best and went out of my way to like do all the campus recruiting, do all that stuff. I really threw myself into it. And you know, my wife tells a story. So I had read like every finance book known to man, and I was really into Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street. And I remember from undergrad, like last minute, I went to some Fidelity on-campus recruiting event, but like I had no chance. And I fell in love with it. It was great. I mean, like, wow, you listen to these guys. It's like such a great career and sounds so interesting. And like Peter Lynch is amazing. And so I said to myself, if they come to campus in MBA, I'm going to get that job. And I literally wrote Fidelity on a piece of paper. I stuck it on my fridge the day I started my MBA, and it stayed there the whole time. And like, that was what I was focused on. And in the end, like, well, the rest is history, but they ended up recruiting and I ended up getting the job. And I told that story of how, like, when I started my MBA and put Fidelity on my fridge, the guy who was hiring me, who ended up being my boss, thought that was like the best thing ever. But it was a real story anyway. So that's my long and circuitous path through a mattress factory to Fidelity Investments.
Fascinating story. And you mentioned some interesting things that I'd really love to get into. But before we get there, I want to ask about your experience in finance, particularly as a portfolio manager. You are exposed to a multitude of choices and risks. And I want to ask about your thinking and rationalization process when hedging against downside risk. What does that look like for you?
So for me, there's lots of ways you can do it, right? You can do it through bet sizing. You can do it through, you can hedge. We don't really hedge. The way I think about risk is I try to, and it speaks to the way I build my portfolio and the way I invest endemically, which is I buy good companies, right? So stop one is I buy good businesses. And my risk control is through the quality of the companies that I buy. So I'm buying good businesses with high returns that have good free cash flow and good business attributes with very and moats around their businesses that should over time protect the risks for me, right? There's obviously risk control about sector sizing and bet sizing and thinking about those things. Mm-hmm. But like at a first stop, the risk controls for me are through the quality of business I'm buying. So that's really the first thing. And then I layer on other things like sector weights and bet sizing. But really it's the quality of business, the balance sheets, the free cash flow generation, and the moats that really control the risk for me. So like my stated strategy is to win in down markets and outperform in up markets. Win in down markets and keep up in up markets. And if you do that over time, and it's not totally intuitive to everyone, but it works with the math. If you do that, if you cut off the downside tails in portfolios and you keep up with the market over time, it actually is a winning strategy because just the way the math and compounding works. So that's really what I'm trying to do.
You mentioned sectors, and I'd love to talk about that for just a moment. Currently, we're seeing investors and money managers rotate out of, be it growth or tech. What happens in an environment in which there is a shift out of owning companies in leading industries and leading sectors?
Yeah. So I try to take a lot of the sector out of my portfolio. So like you can't take it all out, right? Like there's obviously some sectors that I just won't buy, or some that like I struggle with on valuation and things like that. But I try to give my clientele a portfolio that looks like Canada, right? So I run the Canada Fund for Fidelity. My job is to try to give my clients the Canada exposures, right, that are in the Canadian market. I try to generally take the sector risks out. Now, it's like I said, it's impossible to take it all out, but effectively, I do have biases in the portfolio, right? So, like, I have a valuation-driven framework, so tech will sometimes be tough, especially high-flying tech, right? Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to buy Shopify. Like the valuation is full. It's a fantastic business. They've caught lightning in a bottle. It seems like it's the future of small business retail. I found it hard to buy a business like that, right? So that is that's a tough risk to control, especially on a company that goes from 100 basis points of the benchmark to 800 basis of the benchmark in the span of like a year and a half. But I try to offset that with owning great businesses through the cycle. And the other thing about me is I'm pretty patient. So yes, like something might go against me right now and like an industry may be working, but like I know that my framework and my process provide me a true north that I can count on. And through the cycle, like my process generally works. And so I sort of stick to it.
And sticking with that idea is, where do you see the market going in the following 6 to 12 months? Are you nervous about anything in particular?
That's the $1 million question. So I would say that I think the analogy I used with people recently is like the current COVID pandemic, it's the equivalent of we were in a canoe in the middle of a big lake, and like we had a leak in our canoe, and we were sinking, and then we just the vaccine announcement basically allowed us to plug the boat. Now we're still in the middle of the lake and there's water in our boat, but we're not sinking anymore, right? We now know it's not an if, it's a when we're going to be out of this, right? So we've bounded the black hole, as it were, so that we can sort of see, like we're still in the wilderness, we're still in the middle of the lake, but like at least we can see the shore, we can see the end of the tunnel, mm-hmm. right? We know that eventually we will be out of this, right? So that's the COVID dynamic is really the thing overhanging markets the most right now. And I think that we will eventually get out of there. Now, will there be volatility in the economy? Yeah, there probably will be. I think that the way the market, the irony of the way the market and how participants in the market have been positioned, COVID is almost, a vaccine's almost become bad news for a lot of people because they own like COVID winners, right? Like. Mm-hmm. Shopify was down 14% on the back of the vaccine, and you know other names that make up a huge percentage of the market. The very atypical thing that's happened recently is that the stock market and the economy seem very disconnected, and it's almost the irony that a vaccine is probably bad for the high flyers of the stock market. So I think that the concern now is almost like if you're long growth, what do you do? And so I had been legging into decent businesses, things that are a little bit more leisure oriented, good QSR type models where it's like a franchise model, things that are good business models that have been in a normal world are good businesses, but had been hurt because of their exposure to the consumer, right? And so I had been legging into this a little bit. I guess what I worry about is the economy turning really drastically negative, if that is possible from here, given what's been going on. But I think we're almost at the end. And so I've actually been legging into good, but exposed to COVID type of businesses. Mm-hmm.
So I want to stick with that thought just a little bit and ask another final market question is, going into these sectors, what do you look for? What are you looking for right now? Which industry perhaps is currently providing the greatest investment opportunities because of what's happened in the past few months?
Yeah, I think that decent businesses, if you can find them in a normal world that are affected by COVID because of demand, right? Like their business has just changed or it's shut down, are things that are interesting right now. You know, I don't want to go full epicenter for my strategy because I don't want to take on the time frame or the balance sheet risk that some of those, like airlines are tough, right? They're capital intensive industries and like they're not working at all right now. Like that is tougher But if I can find a good business that's capital light, that has a similar type of demand algorithm as airlines, like a similar driver, leisure, mobility, things like that, and it's a good business with good free cash flow and the balance sheet's not too bad, that's where I would be looking. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic insight. So I want to change the course of my direction of my questions a little bit. And you have such an interesting professional journey into achieving and getting to being a portfolio manager at Fidelity Investments. And I think it's key to ask, what are some of the biggest challenges you've encountered throughout your career?
I haven't had that many challenges. I've been very blessed with having a good education and I wasn't really on top of the like what you should be doing in college, and that set me back a little bit, but that's fine. I had a good time. I guess what I would say is once I got to Fidelity, a couple challenges. One, I was the outsider from Canada in a very close-knit sort of traditional market of Boston, where a lot of the people that I got hired with had Ivy League degrees. And I'm not saying that McGill isn't super high quality, which it totally is and stands shoulder to shoulder with all of those places. But there's a degree of outsiderness when you come from somewhere else with not a Harvard, Yale, MIT type of degree. So that was a little bit of a challenge early on. Second, I would say I went through a professional challenge in 2011 where I had a very tough time with performance. So I had just gotten a promotion from sort of just an analyst to an analyst running a fund. And I sort of didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't fully grasp the risks. I didn't really understand how to do what I was doing. And I really failed at it. And it set me back. You know, they didn't give me a ton of time. I had 2 years to do it. And it was pretty bad. So, I mean, I totally deserved to be taken off the fund. The nice part about Fidelity is they gave me an opportunity to do something different and to have another chance. But 11 was tough. You know, I didn't do well at all. And I had to sort of take a step back and rethink about how I do things. And it made me better for it. So I think those challenges in 11 led to an opportunity to do Diversified Canada in 2013. And that really allowed me to build my process and rethink how I think about stocks. And it gave me tons of time to think about that. And that challenge became the basis of the opportunity that led to me becoming a portfolio manager and running our Canada funds. So it made me better. It was a really tough time professionally, and I had struggled with it personally, but you know, I think it makes you better for it. And you know, the adage, and it's a bit trite, but what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's totally true.
Along the same lines, to what skill and or value do you attribute most of your success?
So my wife would say it's my stubbornness. I would say it's my tenacity and hard work, which probably sounds like stubbornness, but nicer. I think that with me, I was never going to let something stop me, right? So I knew what I wanted to do, and I was just, and people would say, like one of my colleagues once said, you just have a don't quitness to you. And I'm like, yeah, I wanted what I wanted. I always wanted to do this, and I was just going to do everything I had to do it. And, you know, I say to people, it's like the person that you look at when you're recruiting or interviewing that, you know, will go through walls. That's kind of like where I was when I started. I just wanted this so bad. And so I read more and I worked harder and I learned more. And it's the person who wins this game is the person who learns fastest. And I'm not saying learns the most of things or like learns about industries from a specific like knowledge perspective, but learns behavioral attributes, or like learns the experiences and has reps at this, so that when you're in the market, you know how to behave, right? So it's about like seeing as much as you can and learning as much as you can, so that when something gets thrown at you, you know what to do. And that's, I think, the thing. Like, I just wanted to do this so bad. And so I did it. And it's, you shouldn't do this job if it's not something you love and want to do, because doing it for reasons that are not, like, this is a hard thing that will require all of your focus. And if you do it because of the money or the notoriety or whatever, that's not a good reason, because it's too hard for that. It's, you have to want to love, you want to look at stocks and look at investing and think about businesses. Like, this is something that you should want to do. And that's where I come from. I just have wanted to do this since, really, when I look back, I wanted to do this since I was 12. I didn't know it at the time, but like, I collected stamps and I collected comic books, and like, I stole my dad's Wall Street Journal, and like, money in the newspaper, right? Like, I didn't realize it then, but like, I wanted to do this since I was 12.
Fantastic, fantastic story. And I want to close off our conversation with two final questions that are going to help our audience, you know, achieve their goals and achieve their dreams when they're trying to break into the financial industry. And one of them, I think, is really important given the current situation and the circumstances. You know, we've seen the word unprecedented thrown around, but it really is, how do you connect remotely with potential recruiters? What's the best advice you can give for somebody trying to leave an impression and trying to land a connection before that interview?
Yeah, I mean, our business hasn't stopped, right? We're still looking for great talent. We're still looking for the next investors that can come to our firm and impact our portfolios. So firms still need good people, right? So like, I wouldn't worry too much. Like, I think that you will all still have opportunities. So that's the first thing I want to say. Like, don't worry, take a deep breath. Like, people will still hire, right? We need good people. So the second thing I'd say is, I think that Zoom interviews and Zoom connections are exactly the same as in-person connections, which is show your passion, show your interest, you know, have read books, right? Have done things to show your demonstrated interest in this industry. Not textbooks, but like, read a couple books, right? Mm-hmm. Read Snowball about Warren Buffett, or The Making of an American Capitalist, or read even Reminiscence of a Stock Market Operator, which is like a fictionalized account of Jesse Livermore from the 20s, who was one of the greatest traders in history. I wrote down some books actually.
Well, great, because you're gonna answer my next question.
Nice. Read One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. Good to Great, which is just a great book about like what makes a great business over time. The Outsiders. Like, read about the industry, right? It's one of the easiest ways to show that you're interested in investing, that if you've read about investing and you have some sense of what you think matters in investing. There's not much else you can do other than like, you know, have been in some clubs and things like that. But like, reading these books will show that you care about it and you want to do it. That's what I look for. I look for passion. I look for someone who's going to work hard. But I also look for someone who's flexible, who can learn from someone who's done this before while still having their own judgment, right? So that doesn't totally answer your question about the Zoom dynamic, like the remote dynamic, but I'm not sure it's that different than it normally is. It's just really about demonstrating interest in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Fantastic answer. And I want to close off our conversation by asking you one final question. Sure. Is, what advice, any final thoughts that you can give to students trying to break in into investments or investing, asset management, and the industry itself?
Yeah, so I do. So I thought early on investing was about the mechanics of investing, right? Like, we all go to school and we learn about investing and we read the finance textbooks and we can all build models and use Excel. But, you know, the irony is, and I used to fall asleep in like the strategy classes and the marketing classes, the irony is I think about that stuff a lot more than the tools from finance classes, because I'm thinking about the quality of businesses and the moats of the businesses and like the Porter's Five Forces and like all that stuff seemed kind of like hokey when I was in school, but it's real and it's important. And so I think that speaks to one thing, which is like, try to be a whole thinker, right? Read books that, like I gave you a bunch of investment books and that's fine, but read books that are not just investing, right? Think outside of just investing and think about, and like engage in all the topics outside of finance when it, with regards to business. So that makes you a whole thinker about business. I think that's one piece of advice. The other piece of advice I would say is work hard, absorb as much as you can. Early on, when you're in your 20s, you have a lot more stamina. You have a lot, you can work a ton, do it. Work hard, engage, pull it all in, learn as much as you can, because that's what's gonna build for you a base that you can build on, right? Life, just like investing, is about compounding, and the more you build up early, the more you can grow your knowledge base and your skill set over time. And the last piece of advice I'd say, I think when I look at the people that we hire, the people that do best with us are both, they walk the fine line of conviction in their ideas, but flexibility in their ideas as well. And that's really hard and it's a conflicting idea, but being both having conviction in your work, but also being flexible and drawing on other people's knowledge is really important. And, you know, we're all smart when we come out of these great schools, but really that dynamic of being flexible is something that I think is really important.
Amazing conversation. Thank you for the wonderful insight. I think it's going to help a lot of individuals who perhaps don't have the guidance, don't have the right circles or networks to tell them what they need to know or not knowing what they should know, which I think is absolutely an asset. So thank you for a wonderful conversation.
You're welcome.
That was my conversation with Ryan Oldham. I really hope you guys enjoyed it. This podcast is powered by the McGill Investment Club. As always, remember to stay safe and stay tuned.